Welcome to another episode of Repeak, a show about remakes, reboots, and revivals because nothing's original anymore. My name is Diana Olympia.
And I'm Stephanie Kim. Today we're going to chat about Netflix's most recent Cyrano de Bergerac-inspired rom-com coming-of-age story, The Half of It. But first, Dio, do you want to talk about some news items?
Yes, there are lots.
Okay.
Well, you sent me one this morning, so maybe you should start. Well, starts with a B, rhymes with Beyonce.
Yes, Beyonce did one of her very exciting random news drops this morning. And apparently she is releasing a new visual album called Black is King on Disney Plus in July. Wait, in July? Is it in July?
Yeah, I think it's July 31st.
So I'm actually really excited and happy that I got upsold into buying a year of Disney Plus when it first launched, and I still have it because I'm going to watch this shit.
Very exciting. So from the news clip that you sent me, it's inspired by Lion King, but is it going to be like any just... Basically, what I'm wondering is the Lion King Disney aspect of it just the jumping off point, or is it a much more deeper, like, this is really a Lion King visual album, or is this a Beyonce thing that I'm just going to use my Disney connection leverage to further propagate it, which is weird to say for Beyonce, because I just don't know who in the world hasn't already been touched by her, if that makes sense. Like, she doesn't need a bigger platform, so I guess I'm wondering what the Disney aspect of it is at all.
Yeah, I couldn't quite tell from that Variety article, but yeah, I think just based on what you said, and I think you're totally right that she has a giant platform already, so I feel like she wouldn't really be partnering with Disney Plus unless, A, they gave her a shit ton of money, which they probably did, and B, like, if it didn't have a direct Lion King tie-in. I was actually surprised to see that she was partnering with Disney Plus on this, because it doesn't that automatically, like, make you assume that it's going to be family-friendly, which most of her stuff is not, so.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, is the G-rated nature of it all.
Right. So, and,
I mean, the title, if you put Black is King in the context of what's happening right now in America, I would assume that it's political.
Right.
But the fact that it's a Lion King tie, that's completely different. So I guess I'm curious what the content is going to be like. And there's a lot of collaborators on here who are also, a lot of whom are also politically active, but who are also involved in Lion King. So Childish Gambino being the primary example, but should be interesting. I'm not really sure what a family-friendly Beyonce product outside of a voiceover for Nala looks like in terms of a music visual album.
Me either. Like, is it going to be animated?
Yeah, great question. I don't know.
I don't know either, but we will see when it drops in July. And
And again, just the nature of being able to keep things like that a secret is just still phenomenal to me. Like, the NDAs that her people must put in place must be very, very impressive, because this is, has she done this three times or two times?
I think this is the third time. Yeah. If you count this as like one of her usual, quote unquote, usual album drops, this would be the third.
Yeah. Just very impressive on that front. So
yeah, I agree.
Should be interesting.
Very exciting. I always love a random Beyonce news update.
I think the other two, well, one was, the headline is about Margot Robbie, basically heading up a new Pirates of the Caribbean movie / probably several movies if this doesn't completely flop. I kind of wanted to also tie that into, there's some chatter about a Sherlock Holmes, Conan Doyle spinoff, where I guess it's the focus is Sherlock Holmes' sister and Millie Bobby Brown would be playing her. And I think just the reason I tied these two together is it kind of goes back to this discussion, this theme that we've been having about, you know, the debate about whether or not original stories versus either a white centric or in this case a male centric IP, what that does. And even though I said there are some cases where I think starting off from a white centric place can still be okay, I feel like in these two cases, it feels not okay. I mean, first of all, for pirates, I mean, they're getting into like Fast and the Furious territory where they're just making like too many of these movies. And I know you'll disagree on that point because there's probably not too many Fast and the Furious movies for you, but the logic being like, we don't need like, I honestly don't think we needed more than two Pirates movies. I think we ended up with like five or something. And the fact that they're still doing this is like unnecessary. And Sherlock Holmes, I mean, who's asking for this? Why do we need to have a spinoff with his sister, or like, just make a female detective? Just make a female detective. It's fine. Like, do people stand Sherlock Holmes so much where they're like, oh shit, the sister? Yeah, I'm into that. Like, it's not even something that drives, like, I don't know. It's not even like very IP exciting to me. Like Sherlock Holmes, not like James Bond or something. I don't know. Maybe that's just me. But what did you think about these or about the Pirates one?
Well, I think that you're having that kind of this kind of reaction because what we talked about before, there's a way to do quote unquote white IP spinoffs with people of color that feels more organic. Like they do the work to actually bring in women and people of color in a more organic way. And like, and you know, Watchmen being the new season of Watchmen being inspired by Ta-Nehisi Coates' The Case for Reparations, and then like bringing in Black writers into the writer's room. And they like obviously did the work to actually tell the story, an authentic story in an honest way, in genuine way. Whereas like this is basically just like, let's just do this thing, but like plop a woman in the middle of it and just see how it does. And it just feels a little bit more like cut and paste-y. And so, yeah, I feel that too. Like, I think we don't really need another Pirates movie. I don't know why they're so popular still, like, but apparently they really, really are. And I will watch anything with Margot Robbie in it. So like, I'll probably watch it and just hope that it's good, but I don't have like super high hopes. And there are like big Arthur Conan Doyle fans for Sherlock Holmes, but also not something that is at all interesting to me.
Yeah, and I mean, I kind of think back to the phrase you used last week, you know, kind of panning to the left. Mm-hmm. This feels like they're like, oh shit, we need a girl. Put the girl there. Put the girl there before we pan to the left. You know, it's like you said, it's not organic. It's very planted. Mm-hmm. It's very coerced and it feels very forced. Mm-hmm. And it feels very set up like, oh, yeah, you panning to the left. Oh, yes, we happen to already have a woman there. It's like, no, the woman just got there 5 minutes ago because you're trying to, like, you know, take advantage of the moment here. I will say that, you know, Margot Robbie is reteaming up with her Birds of Prey writer, Christina Hodson, which is great because the thing that we also see sometimes with these franchises is just the rise of men who aren't really that experienced or just don't really deserve to be helming these things. So I'm all in support of that. And I'm totally in support of Margot Robbie, like you said, and Millie Bobby Brown. I feel like they deserve to be leading their own original stories. And just this feels very, both of these instances feel very much in the shadow of things as opposed to just, hey, I can anchor my own story, but it's the nature of the beast, I suppose.
Yeah. I mean, did you like the all-female Ghostbusters?
Okay. So, confession, I didn't watch it.
Oh, so. if we're doing confession, I have not watched Birds of Prey.
Okay. That's fine. You admitted that. That's fine. I feel like that's more acceptable than me not watching all-female Ghostbusters.
I don't know. I feel like it's about the same because...
Nah. I feel like that was such a big moment when that happened.
Yeah.
Because it's such an iconic group and IP itself. And like Birds of Prey, they're just more tangential. Maybe not Margot's character, but I don't know. They made such a big deal about the all-female Ghostbusters and it felt like a moment and I was just... It's one of those things, and we've talked about this a lot, but... You know, I just heard mixed reviews about it, and granted, maybe those reviews were by men, and so maybe I shouldn't have listened to that or given it much credence, but I think there's just a question of like, do you support a thing blindly or do you support a thing when it's good?
Right.
And when scarcity comes to play, how do you balance that?
Right. And we've had that conversation a lot.
A lot. So that was just a case where I was listening to the reviews and again, maybe I shouldn't have, and maybe I should have been paying attention to who was doing the reviews. So it's my long answer of saying I didn't watch it.
Yeah, that's okay. I mostly feel bad about Birds of Prey because I rented it, and I rented it for a very expensive amount of money, and so that I could get it early. And then I ended up like watching the first 10 minutes and then falling asleep. And then I never went back to it, which is like very unlike me. So,
but at least you gave your dollars. So
I did give my dollars.
That.
Yeah. I gave my
early
dollars.
So mm-hmm. That's good.
Yeah.
One other kind of related note to this. So I don't know if you saw this, but there was an announcement about it's a new show, but it's very much spinning off of Nancy Drew. So it's called Nancy Wu Done It.
Oh, right. I did see. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Wu being W-U. And so it centers around an Asian American author of a popular YA book series that's basically like Nancy Drew. And then it's like this meta thing where like the novelist like gets transported into her world, blah, 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 blah. So it seems like the tie again is like Nancy Drew, which is both, which is white, obviously. And it's very prominent in the name, in the title, Nancy Wu Done It. I don't know. This also rubs me the wrong way because we've also had this conversation. To a certain extent, it comes down to marketing, right? Unfortunately, we've come to a point where there's just so much content and there's so much clutter. You have to figure out how to sell it. And the easiest way is to just be able to do it in a pitch sentence. So it's like, it's Nancy Drew meets X or whatever. And I just feel like it's just becoming more and more of that. And I just, on the one hand, I understand it from like a business and marketing and strategic perspective. But on the other hand, I'm just like, why? Why can't it just be? I think there was a tweet about like, why couldn't this headline have been like brand new Asian American, you know, comedy bought by Amazon, like helmed by blah, 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 blah. But there's just something about the Nancy Drew anchor that I just, that felt flimsy mm-hmm. and just maybe exploitative. I don't know.
Well, yeah, I totally understand what you're saying, and I agree. It doesn't really, well, first of all, the Nancy Drew tie-in doesn't really appeal to me. I don't know, that might just be a personal taste thing, but like I've never really been a big Nancy Drew person, so I wouldn't see that comp and go like, ooh. But I do think like that is just a thing that people do both in publishing and Hollywood. It's all built on like when you're pitching a new novel or pitching a new anything to anybody, you have to like cite comp titles or books that have worked in the past that are similar to this book to prove that there is an audience while also like proving that the book is going to add something new and fresh to it. So it's just like that. But also, I don't know, I get it. But do you remember that that show on Nickelodeon, Mystery Files of Shelby Wu?
I know the name, but I didn't have the pleasure of having cable until I was an adult, so.
Oh my God, that's so sad.
It is sad.
That, I don't know, because I grew up, all I did was watch Nickelodeon, and because I didn't have any friends, so I just watched Nickelodeon and Disney Channel, and that's how I grew up, and yeah, and I just, it reminds me of that, actually, and I'm surprised that nobody really brought that up. And also, does everybody who's a who's an Asian character in a mainstream movie have to have the last name Wu?
Wu is very in this season.
Yeah.
We're gonna talk about Alice Wu in a bit.
Yes.
You got your Alice Wu, you got your Constance Wu, you got your Nancy Wu.
The Wus are cleaning up.
Yeah. It's woo up in here. I don't know.
It's woo up in here.
I that's not my greatest moment. It's starring, I think it's going to star, I don't know how else to say this, the chick from Iron Fist.
The woman who played his girlfriend?
Yeah. I mean, I think there was only one main Asian woman in that. I don't know. I like watched secondhand when someone else was watching it, but she's the main woman in it. So, and I think that's her. So.
I remember her. I like her. I'll watch it. Sure. I'll watch it.
Yeah. I mean, I'll watch it at the end of the day, but I just, I don't know. It's just it's a branding thing that it feels inevitable.
Yeah, I mean,
but also still bothersome.
I don't love Nancy Drew as like a jumping off point in general. If somebody had been like, it's like the Babysitter's Club, I'd be like, oh, yes. Yes, I will watch that. But I don't know. Nancy Drew is just, I never really jived with her.
Speaking of Babysitter's Club, as someone who never read any of them, what was the diversity makeup? Let's start there, of the Babysitter's Club.
This is another confession, but I did this weird thing when I was younger where I like collected books but never read them. so I like,
was there Cliff Notes for Babysitter's Club? How did you
about it? I don't know how I conversed about anything, but my sister had a bunch of Babysitter's Club books, and so like I had hers, and I would do this thing when I was little where I would just flip through stuff and like pretend like I was reading it and then like not actually read it. But
I sort of did that too.
It's such a weird thing. And it's really ironic that I ended up working in publishing. But
dirty little secret.
Yeah. I had like a lot of them. I was also a big like Sweet Valley High person. But for both of those things, I was like a huge fan of the 90s TV shows. The original, not original, because I think there was a movie of Babysitter's Club before the series happened, but there was like a 90s series that lasted a few seasons.
I didn't even realize there was any previous iterations.
Oh my God.
Not surprised, but
so many.
So were there any non-white characters in either of those?
In the 90s version, there is a black babysitter and half Japanese babysitter, which I was like really excited
Hapa.
About.
Okay.
Yeah, Claudia. So in the
Claudia. Okay.
In the reboot, I'm like really excited because they chose a really, really cute Asian girl to play Claudia. And yeah, Claudia in the original 90s TV series is like a little weird, but I just remember there was like one episode where she like goes to the Japanese tea garden to meet her grandma and they talk about her Asian-ness, and I was so like enthralled by that because I'd never seen anything like that on TV before. So like little Stephanie was just like, yes, this is my jam. And then, but yeah, I watched all of that. And then I think because I watched all of that, I was able to pretend like I read the books, but I hadn't read any of the books.
So
big phony.
No, it's we've all done it. We've all done it. In whatever year Titanic came out, I basically, without watching the movie, was able to participate in many a discussion about it because after having participated in so many, I was able to get the main plot points. And so then in the next conversation, I'd be like, yeah, man, was it room on that wood, huh? So I basically did that with Titanic for for several months before actually seeing it.
Oh, okay. I thought you were about to tell me, like, confession, since we're in such a confession mode this pod. Like, I thought you were going to say, like, confession, I've never watched Titanic. And
No, eventually I did.
Yeah, okay.
I got there eventually. But
Did you see Titanic in the theater?
You know, I don't think I did. I think I was able to manage to get away with it until it showed up on, like, TNT or something.
Wow.
Yeah, it seemed really long.
Yeah.
And I wasn't on the Leo train. I don't even know if I was like had reached that part of my life where I was like into movie stars. So,
oh my God.
And I've never really had a Leo thing, I guess, in general. So even if I was, he wasn't my cup of tea.
But not even for like Kate Winslet?
No, because I don't know. What was her big?
That was it.
Before that, was that her? That wasn't her breakout, was it?
Titanic was her breakout, yeah.
Okay.
She had done Heavenly Creatures, which was like her first movie and which was directed by Peter Jackson, and it was her first like actor breakout. It was like what got her more jobs. But in terms of like her mainstream breakout role, I would say it's definitely Titanic for sure.
Yeah. So I mean at that point she wasn't somebody that was like drawing. So yeah, I didn't, you know. And Billy, what's his name? Billy Zane wasn't
Billy
doing
Zane.
It for me either. There was a thing on the internet, I don't know if you've seen it, where basically someone, and I'll have to find out who, but someone redid a few Babysitter's Clubs with Claudia on the cover, but mm-hmm. gave it very like funny titles. So for example, Claudia and the Model Minority Myth. Claudia and the frustrating lack of media representation, Claudia and the whitewashing of Indigenous history, Claudia Kishi only Asian at this damn school, Claudia, my favorite, Claudia thought she told everyone to take off their fucking shoes, which is fantastic, and Claudia just realized this boy has yellow fever. Fantastic. Oh my God, if you haven't
those
seen
are
it.
So true.
It's so great. And I'm very curious to see how they handle it in the Netflix series, even though I've never read anything about it.
I do think that they're starting so young. I'm not sure how they would address racism and stuff because they're like 12, I think, on the show, which is so 12 and 13 or something, which is, I don't remember them being that young on the 90s series, but.
Kids are so woke these days, though. There was a funny tweet where it was like, it was like Teen Vogue, two different covers, one from like, you know, when it was originally out and one now. And the first one was like, Teen Vogue, what shade of lip gloss will make him go wild? And it was like, Teen Vogue, like defund the police or something like that. I just feel like teens and preteens are just, they've just mature so much differently that I'd be curious to see. I mean, I don't know. I don't have anybody in my life who's that age yet. I have a niece and she's getting to be, she's almost on the cusp of that preteen age, but.
Yeah, so is mine.
And I think she's in a mostly white environment. I don't know. It's interesting. I'm like trying to think of how aware I was of that. See, it's weird because I actually grew up, or where I went to school, it was predominantly Filipino. So I was actually the majority. And so it was this weird thing where when I went to school, all the faces or most of the faces that I was interacting with looked like me. But then as someone who was like obsessed with TV and movies, all of those faces did not look like me. So it was like this weird disconnect.
Yeah.
So to your point, yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's too early to talk about race.
No, I think you're right. I think you're right that they're probably going to make it more woke. I'm just curious to see how they're going to approach everything.
So why are they a club? It's just like, hey, we all have the same like teenage occupation. Like, what's the club part of it?
Yeah, so it was like a business plan. Like the lead girl like figured out that, because this was obviously the original version was like pre-internet, and so the lead girl, the girl who founded the club, realized that it would be easier for parents if they had like a pool of girls that at one number they could call to schedule babysitter's appointments, and so they had meetings, I think every day, maybe every week. I think every day, but like every day after school between like 5:30 and 6, they would meet where they would talk about club things, but also just wait for the phone to ring. And then people would, on their flyers, initially they had open for business, like call to make appointments between 5:30 and 6 on X, Y, and Z day. And then so they, parents would call during this club meeting sessions and schedule babysitting appointments.
What did people like about it? Do you know? Or what did you like about it?
I think it's just one of those things where like you're watching girls be like entrepreneurial and they had really strong friendships and each girl got their own storylines. And also like there was infighting sometimes. I remember one episode where one girl has a crush on this guy, but he really has a crush on this other girl. So it's very typical preteen stuff. And it was just like nice because they were all kind of like, every girl had kind of a different personality and a different set of interests, but they were still like really good friends. And so it was just nice seeing that camaraderie. And also it was very like serialized, and sometimes the girls would like go on jobs together, but most of the time they would just do their own thing, and then you'll see them all together at the meeting. So it's like a very comforting like procedural type format.
Yeah, that makes sense. Do you remember where it was set?
I think like somewhere suburban.
Yeah, I mean, I just assume a West Coast like suburb vibe, but I don't know if it has like a Eastern Coast vibe to it.
I can't remember. I would imagine that it's like some Midwestern or Western suburban vibe thing.
Fascinating. Yeah. Fascinating.
Is it?
I'm always interested in things that are of the zeitgeist that I'm not particularly interested in, because it always makes me wonder what I'm missing out on.
This is just clearly a very, like, it's a nostalgia play. There's even a clip in the trailer where the camera shows like one of the old time phones, like a cord phone. And the one of the girls is like, I don't think this is going to work. It's like 25 years old. And I think the girl who plays Claudia says, it's iconic. And it's like clearly a nod to like me and people like me who loved the original.
So. Before we ran out of time, do you know who is also a big fan?
Who?
Natalie Portman.
Oh, obviously, that's why she's my favorite celebrity. Obviously.
She posted on Instagram about it, I think, when the trailer dropped. And I think she said she was a Claudia. Unclear. I'd have to go back and check.
We're going to take a quick break and then we'll talk about the half of it.
Today's spotlight is The Half of It. It is a coming-of-age romance, a retelling of Cyrano de Bergerac on Netflix, set in Squamish, a small town in Washington, where Paul Munsky, a high school jock, hires Ellie Chu, the brightest kid in his class, to express his adoration for their classmate in notes and text messages.
Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun. As always, spoilers are going to follow, so just expect that.
But also, it's been out for like a few months now, so if you haven't watched it yet, like, what are you doing?
Get on it. We're still in quarantine, people. Yeah. Please don't go out there. Stay at home and watch Netflix. This is not sponsored by Netflix, but we will happily be sponsored by Netflix. So do you guys want to reach out to us?
Hit us up, Netflix.
repeatco@gmail.com, I think. We should probably check that before we give out that email address. So why did we want to cover this, Stephanie? Tell the people.
So this is one of many movies recently and in the past that have been inspired by the classic tale of Cyrano de Bergerac, who I did not know before researching that who was an actual person. He was a French novelist and a playwright, and but he also had a very famous play written about him that was part based in truth and part flourishings, as most plays are. But the play was about a man who has famously probably one of the biggest noses in literature, right?
Yes.
A horrendously large nose. And because of this, he is destined to not find love, I guess. And so he settles for helping one of his nemesis. One of the people who he was previously competitive with fell in love with this woman who Cyrano is also in love with, and he decides to help this dude court the woman they're both in love with. And
it's his cousin. He's in love with his cousin. I just want to put it out there.
Oh, gross. Ew.
It's like 1857. Like, of course it's his cousin.
Ugh,
who else is he going to fall in love with?
So many incestual stories in history, man. Ugh.
Did you know that there was even a samurai version of this?
Oh, no, I didn't know. But apparently there's a Korean drama version of this as well.
Oh, why did we not cover that as part of this episode? Wait, was it a drama series or a movie?
Yeah, I think it was a drama series called Cyrano Agency.
Oh, wait. Yes, I do recall that title.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that doesn't really surprise me. They've pretty much done every single romantic trope known to man.
Recently, Netflix has been really pumping these out. They've had, this is the third movie in the last 2 years that has this, the Cyrano story as its backbone. Sierra Burgess is a Loser is one, and that movie was terrible. It just like didn't work at all. And I refuse to rewatch it for this podcast. So I'm not going to tell you what it was about, because I mean, it's obviously about this, but I don't have a better summary than that. And also The Delightful Set It Up has multiple Cyrano references, and they talk about it all the time. And then the lead male character has to pretend like he knows what Cyranoing is when he doesn't know what it is. And it's like a funny joke that they tell. And so this is another version of that, but it's done in a really, I think, delightful and charming way. And it deals with a lot of different perspectives that we don't usually see. And I love this movie.
Wait, Set It Up as in the Lucy Liu movie?
Yeah.
Remind me what part of it was Cyrano based? I haven't seen it in a while.
So Zoe Deutsch keeps saying, like, we should set up our bosses. We need to Cyrano them. We're going to Cyrano them. And like, And then whoever the guy is,
Glenn Powell
is like, yeah, we could totally Cyrano them. Totally. We're going to do that. And then like one of the running jokes is that she keeps saying it throughout the movie. And then he's like, eventually he admits that he doesn't know what Cyranoing is. She keeps using it as a verb, like as like a reference to like them kind of like being the little birds that like set them up. Hence the title.
Also loved that movie.
Yeah, it was so good. That movie's delightful.
I love the entire cast.
Yeah, so, so good. It's such a good, very well cast. And I love that Lucy Liu and Taye Diggs, that's their reunion from their Ally McBeal days, which like,
yes.
Love so much.
Lucy still looks fantastic.
Fantastic. And so does he. Like he.
True that.
They both look like they could still be in their 20s, which is like insane to me, but whatever. I guess some people just have really good genes.
But we are not the only people who enjoyed the half of it, because it currently has a 97% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Wow.
Pretty high. Like, I generally thought from the reviews that people liked it, but 97 was surprisingly high for me. I was pleasantly surprised at that number.
Especially considering the fact that, like, I read a couple of articles that were very, like, anti the ending, which I don't understand why, because I love the ending.
Yeah, in general, I did see a couple very critical articles that had a running theme that this movie had too much going on, which, to be honest, I didn't really notice, and maybe that's, I feel like that can be true, but I still liked it. I don't know that I thought too much about it, but it was interesting seeing that there was so much critique on what is a rom-com. I mean, I just feel like, I don't know if it's like the age of film critique we're at now, or just critique of everything where people have platforms, but like, it's a just joyful rom-com with a queer twist on Cyrano de Bergerac, and it was great. Like, let's just enjoy it. Like, we don't need to get down. And like, Alice Wu hadn't made a film in like 15 years, and I thought she still had a great touch. I mean, I can't say I've had the pleasure of watching Saving Face, but I've heard good things about it.
Yeah, me
and I love the direction on this, and I liked reading about her. She's fascinating. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you did the same, but she, I think, got into MIT at 16.
Mm-hmm.
Ended up going to Stanford also. Was a programmer at Microsoft for ages and ages, and then ended up taking writing classes at night at University of Washington. And then sort of, not really on a whim, but like eventually just decided to try that. And just through sheer will, made her first movie, Saving Face, in 2004, which, have to give a shout out here, along with Teddy Z, Will Smith helped produce that film.
Really?
Yes. So shout out to Will Smith for supporting Asian females. And it was mostly a semi-autobiographical story about coming out to her own mom, because Alice Wu identifies as a lesbian as well in real life. So, I liked reading about this film as well, because did you read the NRA story?
No.
So apparently, you know, she basically stopped doing films to take care of her mom who had gotten ill.
Mm-hmm.
And was just kind of living a normal life. And then she started to kind of come back around into working, and then she kind of talks about how she had trouble working without deadlines. Mm-hmm. So she wrote a check for $1,000 to the NRA. She gave it to a friend of hers, and she said, I'm giving myself 5 weeks. If the first draft of this movie isn't done on August 8th, send that check out.
Whoa.
And so she had that looming over her, and all of her friends were like encouraging her, like, hey, you don't want to be an NRA supporter. And so she basically got it done. And that was the first draft of this movie, which I thought was really interesting.
I mean, that's a really good way to hold yourself accountable.
It's brilliant, right?
Yeah, I don't know. I might end up paying $1,000 to the NRA, but like,
no!
But I should
do
that.
I would give you so much shit for that.
Yeah, I mean, you would probably be the person I would give the check to.
I would probably secretly rip it up and just tell you that I had sent it, and then and then tell you that I'm going to double the amount and send it if you don't finish it in an extra 2 weeks.
Oh my God. I mean, that is definitely a way to combat procrastination, that's for sure.
Yeah, so I thought that was interesting.
That is really interesting. I loved almost everything about this movie. Like, I actually really love that it's a movie that's more about platonic love than romantic love, in my opinion. Yep. Obviously, she's discovering, she, meaning like Ellie Chu, the main character, is discovering her sexuality and how she feels about Aster. And, but like all three of them are just like really lovely at different points. And I just, I love the relationship she has with Paul, the doofy dude, especially because like when they have like this really funny meet cute where she's just like riding her bike and he's like, keeps being like, he's like running up behind her and he goes, hey, hey, hey. And then he like pulls on her back basket, the bike basket at the end of her bike, and she like falls over and she's like, what the fuck, dude? And then and it's just like really funny. And then at the end there's a really, really sweet full circle moment where she's like on a train and he's like running after it going, hey, hey. And then I definitely cried.
Which was a callback to the movie they watched, which was very sweet, where she's basically saying that like it's kind of a pathetic scene, and then she ends up like being moved in her own moment and ends up like kind of starting to cry at the end, which is really beautiful. So yeah, I really liked this film. I agree with you. I like that it was more about platonic love, and I think Alice Wu, the director writer, also talks about how it was very much about self-love. Mm-hmm. And I feel like, yes, there were a lot of elements, but it was because, you know, they were trying to trap you and lure you in with this notion of a Serrano love triangle, but really it was very much about each of these three individuals discovering themselves.
Right.
Paul has his thing with like the sausage and his family business. Ellie has her whole thing about like feeling like she has to stay in the small town with her dad, even though she has, you know, she is very talented and could go elsewhere. And Aster is dealing with her own bold stroke moments of, you know, expecting to get married to her high school sweetheart, but also wanting to be a painter and all this other stuff. So I feel like it was trying to juggle a lot, but I like that because oftentimes you're just seeing the love story part. And those parts were great too. They're very entertaining. They gave you what a typical rom-com should. You know, they did a lot of rom-com gestures, which I enjoyed. You know, they had the whole back and forth mural wall writing painting, which was very sweet. They had, when Paul discovers the letters that Ellie writes to paper editors for him. So cute.
Yeah.
Like when so he hands cute. Her the guitar at the talent show, also really sweet. So I felt like it gave you all those things and delivered on all those things. And then also was like, but hey, they're also just like kids who are lonely and trying to figure out their place in the world. And being 17 is kind of shitty, especially when you're in a small town and you feel like it's your whole world. So I thought that she did a great job of exploring that as well.
Yeah, I'd say this is probably 2/3 a coming of age story and 1/3 a rom-com. If I had to like break it down, it's definitely more about them kind of figuring out their place in the world and like who they are as people. And then the romance happens to be like the catalyst by which they all meet and like start to interact with each other. But it's really more about their respective relationships and like, and you know, Aster has to deal with her dad's the town pastor and she has to deal with that and like figure out what believing in God means to her. And yeah, so I think that there are a bunch of like really interesting things. And then also, obviously, Ellie is dealing with being the only Asian American immigrant in the school, or if not the town, and like, and having her mom pass away at an early age and like what that did to her and how fast she had to grow up and like her relationship with her father and all of that. And then Paul just has his
taco sausage.
Yeah, sausage business, as you were talking about. But they just all kind of, they felt like real people to me, which I really, really liked.
Yeah, and I thought it was interesting. I don't know if you stumbled upon this in your writing as well, but Alice, who talks a lot about why she decided to set it in Squamish, mm-hmm. Which is a fictional rural town in Washington. And it sounds like she was, you know, reading a lot about Trump and, you know, rural areas of the country and, you know, people with very conservative values. And she I think she's kind of hoping for like a Will and Grace thing, right? Where like it's so entertaining and people are so charmed by it that they have their eyes open to certain walks of life that maybe they otherwise wouldn't have been open to. Mm-hmm. And she talks about why she chose Netflix, because apparently she had two other offers. And I guess they did an initial screening in a conservative town in Phoenix. And the reviews were really positive, which she was surprised at. And then I think one of the questions on the survey was, would you recommend this to friends to see? And they said, no, this is for me, but not for my friends. And so she worried that people would be afraid to watch it in theaters. And so she was like, well, people will be, you know, if they're closeted who want to change their mind, they're just not willing to say it. Maybe they're more inclined to do it in the privacy of their own home. And so that's why she eventually ended up going to Netflix. So I thought that was interesting as well.
Yeah, that's really interesting. That's a really, really interesting take on why she decided to go with a streaming platform. And I think that does make a lot of sense.
And it was kind of going back to what we talked about last week a little bit when it comes to format and, you know, why Netflix might be, or, you know, just certain platforms might be better for certain objectives.
I agree. I think that that was a really smart choice on her part, because I do remember the director of The Farewell, she specifically said that she had gotten an offer from Netflix, but like turned it down because she just wanted a different experience. And then she like pointed out in one of the directors, I think it was the Hollywood Reporter Directors Roundtable, but she was saying like, if a studio like A24 hadn't picked it up, then The Farewell wouldn't be getting like the Oscar buzz that it's getting now. It could have just gotten lost on Netflix, was her point. For that reason, she is happy that she didn't go for it. But like in this case, I feel like it's really interesting and like a very smart move that Alice Wu went with Netflix instead. Because I think that's totally right. Kids who are this age who are confused and might be interested in watching this, they're not going to like admit that they want to watch this because they're, you know, in public. So I think that that's really fascinating. But also I didn't really think, I thought it was interesting because like I listened to an NPR interview with her, with Alice Wu, and she mentioned like, we don't really ever really know what Ellie's interests are sexually. Like she could be bi, she's only 17, like she doesn't know yet. And so I just thought it was like really interesting that she left it like open-ended like that.
That's true. It was interesting because a few of the articles that I read felt frustrated that they basically didn't like full on convert Aster or something. I don't know. That was the sentiment that I got, and that there was a lot of missed moments. But to your point, I think especially at that age when you're just figuring out who you are in general, your sexual identity is, I mean, so complex and not something that you're just going to figure out in one day or even one school year. And so the fact that it's unclear for Ellie, but also unclear for Aster, you know, they have that scene at the end of the movie where Aster says, you know,
I'll see you in a few years.
But before that, she says, you know, I have to admit that the thought has crossed my mind, you know, if things were different, if I were different. And then, yeah, she says, I'll see you in a couple of years. And I think that gave it room as well.
After that epic kiss.
After the big kiss. The first time I watched it, I was like, fuck yes, girl, go get your kiss. I was so proud of her. And
so proud.
I thought they did a great job at giving Ellie some really big, satisfactory, big, bold stroke moments. I thought that was one of them. And the other one was the talent show. But yeah, that was definitely the big, bold stroke that I'm really glad they gave her at the end.
Yeah, I agree. And I think sexuality is still so fluid, too. And I think that's something that the younger generation definitely embraces. Like, I think Gen Z for sure embraces that sexuality is fluid and like be what you want to be when you want to be it. It doesn't really matter. But I think maybe for people who are a little bit older than us, don't understand that or like don't think that that's a real thing. But I really appreciate that this left things kind of open for interpretation and also, yeah, to what you were saying, didn't force like any labels on anyone.
Yeah, that was another, I think, critique that I saw somewhere, is that someone said that they wanted the film to focus more on kind of the conservative nature of the town in specific to the church.
Yeah.
And it's so much of a backdrop, and that could have added some additional like weight to it. And there's like that scene that some people felt was out of place where after Paul kisses Ellie and realizes that he likes her, that he, I think he's worried that he's gay, or his mom is worried that he's gay.
Mom's worried because he Googled, like, how do you know you're gay after the, yeah, after
right,
the
because
incident.
He's wondering, right?
Yeah.
So, some people felt that that was out of place and that they wanted more focus on that. But I don't know. I think it was fine as it was. But I think, as we're saying, you know, it's just hard to really cover that in a satisfactory way, because it's just something that is, like you said, fluid and evolves over time. So I feel like even if they did try to focus on that, they would have to like have a longer period of time where they do like a time jump or something, because yeah. I don't think they're accurately going to get that in one fell swoop.
Yeah. And I also think I actually, the first time I watched it, I was really taken aback by Paul saying like, it's a sin, you're going to go to hell. And then I watched it again. And then upon second viewing is when I realized how conservative and religious this town is supposed to be. And if you pay close attention, they do drop it a lot. But I think that it, like, I understand why people were a little bit shocked by that, because if you're not watching closely, then like maybe you don't realize like how conservative this town is supposed to be. But I think Aster's dad is a pastor and they go to church every Sunday and they talk about believing in God. And even when Aster first meets Ellie in the hallway, when Ellie's dropped her books and Aster's helping her, and Ellie's like, I'm Ellie Chu. And she's like, I know you're sitting behind my father every Sunday. You're his favorite heathen. And those things are like constantly, I think Alice Wu decided to just make that a little bit more subtle and didn't want to shove it in our faces, basically. And I actually really appreciate that, because I don't think I would have liked it as much if I felt that constricting thing that I always feel when I watch anything that has to do with religion, first and foremost. I don't think I would have enjoyed watching this movie as much if that had been more in the forefront.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think that that should have been the lens. I don't think that using that lens would have given it anything more interesting to me personally. And the way you're going to get to me is through a rom-com, so keep it that way.
Well, do you want to take a quick break and then we can do gripes? Because I have them. Do you?
Ooh. I have a few questions. I don't know if I'd call them gripes. Gripes feels aggressive.
Okay. Nitpicks? Is nitpicks less aggressive than gripes?
It is. Comments?
Sure.
Questions? I don't know.
I have some feedback. Let's say that.
Feedback. I like that.
That's aggressive. I don't know.
It's more passive aggressive. Did you watch Wine Country? Is that the name
yes.
of the film?
Yes.
Yeah. After that, it became like a running joke with my girlfriends from college. Like, we took a trip together shortly after that movie came out, and the whole time we were like, may I offer you some feedback? And it was hilarious.
Oh my God. I've been in corporate America for too long. That was my gut way of being passive aggressive. I may offer you some feedback. An old colleague of mine who I really liked at the time, but I, like, looking back, I think she was kind of being a little bit condescending, and she shall remain nameless, but she would say, can I offer you some unsolicited advice?
Ooh, that is like 100% worse.
Is it?
then may I offer you some feedback?
Yeah, well.
Because like she's more owning, like, I know you don't want to hear this. And it's just so much more of an upfront negative tone. It's like not even pretending.
I mean,
I don't know.
I don't know. I always said like, sure, because like, I don't want to be one of those people who is like not open to feedback. I always want to be open to feedback, but I don't know now, like, what is like, what's the best way to give that feedback? I don't know.
But I feel like the way that it is such a leading question, because it does exactly what you said. It puts you in a position where you feel like you're the dick if you don't say yes.
Right.
So in that way, it feels not great, because you're just phrasing it in a way where you're putting the onus on the other person.
All right, well,
I don't think we're gonna solve this in 2 minutes, but it's something we will continue to talk about, and if anybody has any ideas, add us in the comments or add us on Twitter.
This, ladies and gentlemen, is why I could not make it in corporate America. Okay, like, this is why. And I actually like the term gripes, and even if it is aggressive, which I am an aggressive person, I am definitely not conflict averse. I have some gripes with this movie.
Ooh, can we call it grapes?
Grapes? Oh, yeah, okay. Let's squash some grapes.
Yeah. Oh, I like that. See, we're going to squash some grapes and make wine. Boom. I just made it into alcohol, motherfuckers.
Oh, man. I had wine. I should have poured myself a glass of wine.
Well, we're about to take a break, so you can do that. And if you're listening to this, you can also grab yourself a glass of wine, and we'll be back in just a moment.
Yep. I'll be back with my wine, so please have yours.
You were saying you're psychic?
So remember I told you I was starting to think that I'm psychic because I can tell when people are going to break up with me friend-wise.
And okay. Sorry. It has a very specific focus. Yes.
Right. And so this happened when I went to go get my wine just now. I was like, and it's boxed wine because I'm a very classy person. And so I was going to get it, and I filled up my wine cup, my little mason jar glass, because I'm also a hipster. and it was red wine, and I was like, oh, and I have white carpet in my apartment, and I was like thinking, and for those of you who don't know, but I've mentioned it almost every episode, so I don't know why you wouldn't know at this point, I have a walking disability, and so carrying liquids at times can be difficult for me. And of course, usually how I combat this is that I only fill whatever cup I'm using, like, up halfway so that when I, like, walk around and, like, kind of, I kind of, like, waddle like a penguin, but, like, which is how I explained it to my nephew. So to, like, combat the liquids going everywhere and, like, spilling everywhere, I only fill the cup halfway. And like, as I was filling the cup, I was like, oh, how much would it suck if I, like, spilled some on the carpet? And of course, because I'm, like, thinking about this, I do.
Self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah, self-fulfilling prophecy for sure. And so that's what happened. And I think, yes, it is definitely a self-fulfilling prophecy thing, but also I might be psychic, so
there's a 60% chance it's already raining.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly how I think my psychic powers work.
Karen. one of the Karens I'm okay with in this moment in time.
Oh, she's a delightful Karen.
Oh, so good.
Yeah.
And then she's now Mamma Mia. Mamma Mia and up.
And, well, she's in, like, a ton of stuff.
I mean, I know. I'm just thinking about it because, this fits into the podcast. They're talking about doing a Mamma Mia 3 because apparently, quote, it was made to be a trilogy. Somebody said that.
Bullshit.
Production.
Bullshit.
Did you watch the second one?
I love the second one. I went to see the second one. I went to see the second one twice.
She says bullshit
after
saying that she loves the second one and saw it twice in theaters.
Yeah. I don't know what to tell you. You know I go see things repeatedly in the theater all the time, especially after I got the after movie pass, and then I got the AMC version of movie pass, and it's just one of my favorite activities. And when I really fucking love a movie, I will want to go see it again. And a lot of people don't want to go see movies again, so I just take different friends.
I mean, I guess if you're going to pick a band to do this with, you want somebody who has a deep catalog like ABBA. But still.
I mean, their songs are delightful. Who doesn't like ABBA?
I know.
ABBA?
I grew up on that. My parents had many of their CDs, so I'm all about it.
My parents just also loved ABBA. It must just be like a 70s thing. They all grew up in the 70s, so it's like a requirement to like ABBA.
I definitely buy that. So there was a lot of ABBA karaoke requests.
Yes, us too.
In my house.
It's always like ABBA and the Beatles. And also, remember that teen group that was on Disney Channel all the time called A-Teens?
Oh, yes. What was their song? Also S Club 7. But,
yes, yeah. I loved S Club 7. S Club 7 had their own TV show. But
oh, that's right. Wasn't it like a meta fake reality show?
Yeah, it was.
Oh, God.
And
why do I know
Barcelona.
These things? Sometimes I have to explain to my boyfriend that he, like, knows real things and that my brain, like, is filled with lots of knowledge, but not about anything that's practically useful.
That's also me, is that I...
Yeah.
Yeah, so. Anything that's, like, I'm, like, shit a trivia because I don't know a wide enough breadth of things. I only know about, like, a lot about completely frivolous, useless things. Yeah. Yeah.
Same. In the many times you and I went to that trivia group in New York, I don't know how much we contributed
to
that.
We really didn't. Unless there was some random, like, pop music category or, like, even the Oscar categories were so deep that I didn't do that well in them. And like, yeah. Whatever. Whatever.
I went for the cheap beer and food, so, and yeah. The company. So
I really like the company and the ritual of it. So I'll still go to trivia, but I can't promise anybody in a trivia group who wants like a ringer that I am that, because I'm not.
Yeah.
But at A-Teens, originally their name was Abateens. And then
that's right. Yeah. That's right.
And then the bandmates were like, cool, like, we think it's so great that you wanna pay homage to us, because all of their first songs were covers, ABBA covers.
Ugh, yes. Oh my god, this is all flooding back to me. Yeah. Jesus Christ, I'm having a moment right now.
Yes.
Where the hell do we stream this?
but then, like, I think the original bandmate members were like, so that's cool, but like, can you not use our name? And and so that's why they changed it to A-Teens. Fun fact. Long tangent.
Also Swedish.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wait. Is S Club 7? Oh, yeah. A-Teens were definitely.
I'm saying A-Teens. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. They were definitely also Swedish.
From Stockholm. So during the break, like the nerd that I am, mm-hmm. I went ahead and Merriam-Webster dictionary feedback and then went to thesaurus. I feel like observation just feels more accurate, because that's what you're doing. I just feel like gripe is like, you don't have a gripe with Alice Wu. You don't have like a gripe with a movie, but you're like,
no,
I noticed something.
I definitely don't have any gripes with Alice Wu. I respect her as one of the only working female directors who is also openly gay. I think female Asian directors, I mean, can you think of anybody else that hits all of those intersectionality sections? Probably not. But so I very much respect her, but I would say I feel fine with saying I have some gripes, but then also saying that I respect Alice Wu. Both things can be true at once.
I just feel like grapes was a good compromise.
I think grapes is a perfect compromise.
All right, hit me with some of your grapes.
Okay, so they have Yogurutu in this movie, the drink that was made mainstream popular, I would say probably by To All the Boys I've loved before, which we love. The original one, not the sequel, because the sequel was terrible. But so this is a traditional, I think it's Korean, but I could be wrong. But I just grew up drinking, or my cousins grew up drinking it a lot. I, spoiler alert, actually don't like it, which kind of makes me feel less Korean. And when I tell other Koreans that I don't like this drink, they're like, who are you? That's not allowed. But my point is, they have this drink in the movie and they reference it, and it's actually like she's getting a bunch of these at the vending machine when Paul tries to kiss her and they have that awkward moment. The way they say it, they butcher the pronunciation. It's basically just like a Koreanized pronunciation of yogurt, and I don't understand how they couldn't have just pronounced it correctly.
That's fair. Yeah, one of my observations was that there was a bit of an overlap between To All the Boys, because I was like, what's with like Netflix rom-coms and Asians in the Pacific Northwest and having Asian grocery stores that are far away from our main characters and them loving this probiotic milk drink?
Yeah, I don't know.
So I was like, there's a lot of some similarities.
Yeah, there are a lot of similarities there. So weird.
Munsky's last name is very much like what's his name? Like it has that like what like last
Kavinsky,
name vibe.
Yeah.
Kavinsky, Munsky, yeah. Kavinsky.
Are they both Polish? Huh? I think they are both Polish, because he has that whole sausage thing throughout the whole movie.
But how do we know Kavinsky's Polish?
I don't know.
Just because of Kavinsky?
Yeah. It's just a guess. I don't want to generalize. I don't want to generalize and stereotype. I'm sorry.
To our Polish listeners, please chime in the comments.
Yeah.
The other thing I will say is that, so I've never tried it. I have a pack in my refrigerator right now, and I'm wondering if I should do a live tasting for the very first time.
Do it.
All right. Give me 1 second.
Ooh.
Oh, yeah. This is some ASMR. Live and active probiotic. Here we go. Shake gently. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I'm nervous.
Don't be. I hear they're good.
But you said you don't like them.
I don't like them, but I think that that's like a relic of me being little and not wanting to try things.
Ooh. I like this.
Do you?
Yeah. So it's like, it doesn't really feel like it has the texture of milk. It feels like closer to a juice.
Yeah.
There's something in this that I can't quite put my finger on. It's very sweet.
Does it taste nostalgic to you?
Well, I did get it from an Asian grocery store, and that's nostalgic for me.
Yeah.
It's not like a tang, but it feels like a powdered, like it does give me nostalgic vibes of like orange powdered drinks.
Interesting.
But like also milk. And it's funny because, yeah, I also have some garlic snacks from my Asian grocery that I got recently. What are your favorite Asian snacks, just because we're on the topic?
Okay, so this is my part of my gripe, is that there are so many other Asian snack things that they could feature. And I guess this is, like, the most mainstream one, I guess. But, like, why do they both have to feature this? Because there's a drink, actually. I don't remember what it's called, but there's a drink that has, like, you know, Concord grapes, like the inside of Concord grapes? It has like de-skinned Concord grapes in the grape juice.
Ooh, I would be very into that.
It's so good and so like refreshing in summer. Also very sweet, but like not in like in a very like understated Asian way, not in an overpowering way. But like that drink is really, really good. And also we have these things called chuchupas, which are kind of what they sound like. They're like these like ice, like these plastic like little tubes of ice things, like a Go-Gurt type of tube, but like clear and plastic and kind of filled with like colored flavored ice, and you just suck on it and like eat it. And like when I was growing up with my cousins, that's like All we ate over the summer were chuchupas, like in between like going out to the trampoline and like playing and stuff. And then my cousins would drink yogurts, but like I would just not.
It's delicious, I have to say.
I just don't
into
know,
it.
I don't know why. I mean, I'm glad you're into it, because like I'm glad anybody's into Korean anything. But yeah, I was just never a big fan. And I hope that Koreans listening don't disown me from my own people for saying this. I love kimchi, guys. I love all other types of Korean food. But I would say I'd prefer the grape drink over this.
Interesting. Okay. No, I'm with that. I think for snacks, Hot Flakes was like a big part of my childhood.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever had Hot Flakes?
No.
So the thing about them, especially for Filipinos or those who are raised in the Catholic tradition, is they're little cylindrical stacks of these like sweet, not, it's not like tamarind. Apparently it's called like Chinese hawthorn, which is a fruit. Mm. But they sold them at like the Filipino store, which was like our local like bodega in Atwater that was run by Filipino people. So we just called it the Filipino store, even though they had like Asian treats. But I feel like it was a part of a lot of like Asian Americans' childhoods. And so they look like tiny communions, pieces of communion. And so like we would like pretend to like give each other communion, which is like 100% sacrilegious and very ironic.
Oh, of course. I was like, oh, how cute. But I didn't think it was a sacrilegious thing.
Yeah, no, definitely like probably a no-no. So yeah, I would say that would be my substitution if we feel like the probiotic category has been saturated.
Yeah.
Ellie Chu, here was one observation. Her essay pricing?
Too low.
Too low. Thank you. Jesus Christ. $20 for a 3-to-10-page essay?
Yeah.
Girl, you need to tier that out more. 1-to-3, 3-to-5, 6-to-10, $20, and you're busting out like 6 of those a week or
unless
a day?
It's not that hard for her, but writing always took me a shit ton long time. I'd be charging at least 50 to start.
But she's saying that she wrote 6 different takes on Plato. I mean, that can't be insignificant.
Right.
Just on the variety alone and making sure you're not like making it obvious, even though your teacher is clearly in on it, feels like maybe in very Asian fashion, she's lowballing herself.
I agree with that. Those prices were very low. You should have started at 50, girl. But that dovetails very nicely into my second gripe, which is that why is Mrs. Horvath, aka the teacher, okay with cheating?
Mrs. G.
Yeah.
AKA Hannah Horvath's mom from Girls.
Yes. Uh-huh. And also the mom on Freaks and Geeks.
Freaks and Geeks. Yep, mm-hmm. yep.
We love you.
Why did she like, or did she condone it?
Yeah. I mean, I'm really glad she's getting work and all that. And like, I'm happy. But cheating was a zero tolerance thing at my school. Ironically, though, that didn't stop kids from cheating. And Charlie Gibson came to our school once to tape a Nightline special or GMA special on the rampant
That's amazing. Cheating. Oh, my God. I want to watch that episode.
Oh, my God. It was so bad. I don't even know if it's, like, online. But it's so bad.
That's amazing. Your parents must have taped it.
I mean, like, I wasn't in it. But it was, like, it was a big thing that it was, like, my school was. But we had a lot of random shit happen to us because also we are my school's also part of the same school district that Remember the Titans was based in. So, like, our football team was, like, featured on some of the old footage that Denzel Washington shows in that movie.
Oh, that's cool.
And also, we had, like, the biggest gym in the state or something like that. And so one year in middle school, we hosted a concert for 98 Degrees and Dream, and I went!
Shut up. That is amazing. Yeah. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
That is fucking cool. My high school's only claim to fame is Tyra Banks and now the Duchess of Sussex.
Wow. Wait, Tyra Banks went to your high school?
Yes. She has worn her high school ring in, like, two episodes of America's Next Top Model.
Wow.
And the Duchess did give the, like, virtual address to this year's class.
That's
which
cool.
Went sort of viral and was covered by a few news outlets.
That's really cool.
Yeah. But yours is very cool, too. I mean, 98 Degrees, that's, like, the coolest thing at the time.
I was really into Dream at the time, too. Remember that whole, like...
Dream. Jog my memory.
They were one of those, like, pre-making the band...
I see
Daddy
Dream
bands.
Street and Dream. Are they... Which one is it?
Okay, Dream Street is Jesse McCartney's boy band, and Dream is the girl band that I was obsessed with. So they're two different things.
I don't think I ever knew about Dream the girl band.
I loved Dream the girl band.
Wait, tell me more about it.
I don't remember any of their singles, but I do remember them being, like, around the same time as Willa Ford was a thing. Do you remember Willa Ford?
I do remember Willa Ford. Is this, like, the precursor to Danity Kane?
I think probably, yeah. I think that, because this is before Making the Band happened.
Okay, it says, yeah, 98, but they left some talent scout and were signed by Sean Combs to Bad Boy. So I'm just imagining if this was, like, a pre-DK.
Yeah, it definitely was pre-DK. I think they were, like, as, like, the young Twitter kids would say, or the meme kids would say, Dream walked so DK could run.
Again. Oh, wow. Okay, that puts it into perfect context. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Is what's her face, Camila?
Camila Cabello was from Fifth Harmony, which is post-DK.
Yeah, so I was going to say, and DK walked so that Fifth Harmony could
Yes,
run,
absolutely.
Right?
Yes.
Isn't that the case?
Yeah, that is 100% the case. Yes.
Okay. All right. Glad we cleared
that up. Yeah. I mean, what are we if we don't reference girl bands and boy bands of the 90s? Because apparently we do it every episode. So we have to check that box.
Every episode. happy birthday to Ariana Grande. She turned 27.
Aww,
she got the
birthday chef
of Nobu to come to her house and cater a meal for all of her friends.
Wow.
And it was like a Midsommar theme. So they all had like flower crowns.
That's really
and
cool.
She posted. She had, like, a photographer, and, like, there was a bunch of pictures, and her boyfriend are smooching in it. It's very cute.
Speaking of Ariana Grande, Timothy Chalamet!
Ugh, damn it.
Yes. Thank you.
Are we going to talk about him and his new lady?
No, I don't want to. I want to believe. Wait, I think that his new lady is not age appropriate. Maybe I'm being too judgmental.
Really?
I'm not sure that she is.
How do you know? How old is she?
I don't know, but she seems older than he is. But maybe that's just because he's, like, very thin and little. So I could be wrong. And
I just, like, those pictures, I just don't understand the appeal. He's, like, this, like, lanky white thing holding a guitar and his hair is, like, a mess. And I'm, like, I don't understand.
I don't really get it either. Like, you know, I love him, but it's not in that way. Like... I love him and I think he's delightful and I would want him to be my best friend. Like, I want to keep him in my pocket forever. I don't want to be, like, romantically involved. And I really,
oh my God,
like...
is he your Paul Munsky?
Yeah.
Not to bring it back. But also, did you know that Alice Wu said it was based on, like, a real life thing of hers?
That's cute. And you know how much I love platonic relationships. So obviously theirs was my favorite and it made me really mad when he tried to kiss her and, like, ruined it because... not everyone.
Oh, yeah, we talked about this. We talked about this in Normal People episode.
Yeah, yes. I love platonic male-female relationships. I really wish I had one. If anybody wants to be my Paul Munsky, I'm available.
There will be a sign-up sheet in the show notes. We will be taking submissions now. But yeah, I thought that was really sweet because I didn't realize that that was, you know, semi-autobiographical for her. She said that when she came out to her parents, you know, they weren't pleased with it and there was a lot of distance. And she ended up, like, really getting close with, I think, a guy in her computer science class who she said was from the quote-unquote heartland. So very much a Paul Munsky type. And she said that they lost touch. And so I thought that was an interesting perspective at the end of the movie because, you know, you're kind of wondering, especially as she goes off into the world, you know, he stays behind. Like, is it realistic that they would still be friends? And is that okay that someone can be a part of your life at a really important stage and mean so much to you and help you discover who you are and that they would no longer be in your life afterwards? And it seems like that's the case in real life for her. And I don't know. I thought that was kind of still sweet in a way, even though it's kind of sad.
Yeah.
That you could still have a person like that in your life at some point.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of friendships are like that. At least mine, a lot of mine have been like that. Like my, I don't really talk to my really close high school friends, but I still really value their friendship. We didn't have like dramatic breakups or anything. Well, some of them. Yeah, we did. But like the ones that I was really close to, I didn't have dramatic breakups with, but we just like fell out of touch because that's what happens when you live in different cities and have different priorities and have different career paths. You just don't talk as much anymore. But like, I don't value their friendship and what it meant to me back then any less. And so I think that is something that Alice Wu does really well, is like depicting that kind of like very pure coming of age friendship. Like you happen to run into these people at a time in your life when you're really figuring yourself out, and you help them and they help you, and you mutually push each other, which they, I think Ellie and Paul and Aster, like all collectively do for each other at different points, which is why I really think they as like a unit are really powerful. But they're, all three of them are headed on different paths, which I think the ending made very clear. And yeah, I didn't really interpret it as, I've read different articles that say like, you know, everyone hopes that they'll stay in each other's lives, but I kind of read it as like, they won't. And like, that's okay too.
Yeah. Same.
Very Call Me By Your Name-esque.
Yes. Yeah. Ends with crying.
Yeah, it does. Oh, God damn it. I should have saved my Timmy mention for that because that was more organic.
Any other grapes?
I have one more gripe.
Go for it.
Grape, which is that they make a whole point of the dad having terrible English, and that's why he's not able to get a good engineering job. But like, his English is fine.
Are you basing that on the movie quotes he's memorized?
Yeah.
Because his French is also fine.
Yeah.
By that standard.
Like the accent is not that thick. Like his English is fine. Like my parents have thicker accents than that. So.
I mean, it's Squamish. Like maybe that, you know, their threshold of English is, you know, Squamish.
He also makes a point of being like the phone company won't understand me because my accent, and like, but your accent is fine? I don't understand.
Oh, I was going to say, did you happen to ask any of your friends that speak Mandarin or are comfortable enough with it to judge her Mandarin? I feel like I always do this. Like after the farewell, I asked all my like Chinese friends. I'm like, yo, how is her accent? They're like, ooh, not good.
Oh, it's terrible. Yeah. My one of my really close friends, she like didn't love the farewell because Awkwafina's accent was so terrible. And then I kept being like, yeah, that would really put me out of it too. Like if it was in Korean and she had a terrible accent. And then I kept being like, but she is only half. She's like half Korean, half Chinese. But I didn't really hear anything.
On that note, one last thing. The scene I really liked was when Paul finally makes the taco sausage for Ellie and her dad. And instead of having like a very American reaction, which is to be like very effusive and all that stuff, they kind of just have this like silent approval. And I thought that was so Asian and so perfect.
I think one of the interesting things that Alice Wu said in one of her interviews to that point is that she mentioned that her relationship with her parents was a little bit different, and that the word in Chinese, like, kids and parents don't really say I love you. That phrase is really reserved for, like, romantic love, and, like, instead of saying I love you, you, like, do things for each other, and you just kind of sit in front of the TV and eat dinner together, which is, for me, that's a very true Asian thing. And so I just felt very, like, yeah, this is, like, very accurate to, like, how an Asian parent is with their kid. Like, they love them more than anything, but, like,
God forbid they say it. Yeah, no, I think it's actually, I didn't think about it until this moment, but I think it's actually another, goes to her point about platonic love. Like, the whole conceit of the movie is that, mm-hmm. you know, she starts with that Greek myth, like, kind of that Greek framework about how, you know, we as humans used to be basically one, joined into one thing and then got broken apart. And so it's about finding your other half. And, but it's really not about that. And there are many ways to show love. And so I think to that point about how typically immigrants, especially from Asia, show love or show affection to their children and vice versa, it's not always familiar to those that are outside the culture. And it might seem different, mm-hmm. but it is something that I think we've grown accustomed to understanding as, you know, I don't know if you've ever read that book, like The Five Love Languages.
Yeah.
I feel like there's a sixth one for Asians because, or I guess it's service. I guess service is technically, like, that would be the Asian one. But right. I think it's just another point to showing different ways of love and how it's just different.
Did you ever say I love you to your parents growing up?
I think I remember it, but it felt very, like, more, I don't want to say robotic, but it felt more like a learned behavior mm-hmm. than, like, an organic thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's still a strange thing. And even, like, physical forms of affection, I feel like I didn't really do that a lot. And that's still kind of something that's not weird for me, but it's just something that I guess I'm not really used to doing.
Are you not a hugger?
I've become more of a hugger over the years, but instinctively, no. I also was not much of a crier. I think it was only up until a few years ago where I just started openly doing it, but it became, like, almost this, like, weird, stupid, naive, like Girl Scout badge that I wore that, like, I hadn't cried in a long time. And I don't know if that's because
you were like Cameron Diaz in The Holiday.
Oh my God, I was totally Cameron Diaz in The Holiday. Like, just one tear. Just come on. I hate love that movie so much.
What?
Yeah, and then I just kind of got over it.
Wait, wait. Did you just say I hate that movie so much?
I said I hate love that movie.
I love that movie.
No, I mean, I love it, but, like, there's a lot of grapes that I have with it. Like, let's be real.
What grapes do you have with that movie?
Like, come on. Like, what do you mean? We don't have enough time to cover this in one episode.
We have plenty of time to get into it, okay? We have plenty of time to get into it. Tell me.
Like, where do I be? No, I mean, it's like Love Actually. I also have plenty of grapes with that movie.
It's a Christmas classic.
And it also is problematic. There's some, like, I feel like there's some, like, consent things in that movie.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
The age of consent didn't exist until, like, 2018.
It didn't, though. I'm just kidding. For everybody who's listening, I believe in consent.
Like, Cameron Diaz, great, and I've said this on another episode of ours, fantastic comedic actress, has been in some of, like, the most, like, iconic rom-coms in the last, you know, of the 90s and the aughts. Her performance in that is so over the top in some scenes, and I can enjoy it because I respect her career and what she has brought, but, like, there's, like, a lot of those scenes where she's fighting with Ethan at the beginning. Oh my God. Like, it's so much. It's so, 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 so much. I don't even know if you really loved me, Ethan. I mean, just some of the delivery is just like, so unnecessary.
I kind of thought it was true to the character.
I thought it was true to the character for a film written in that year. But if I'm talking about classic performances, I don't know that I would have kept all those scenes. And look, part of it is probably also the writing and directing, so let's not all put it on Cameron. But, and I respect her in real life because she was like, you know what? I've done my time. I'm no longer going to do movies anymore. I'm going to just be married and, like, does she have kids now? Do they have kids? Her and Madden? Okay. I'm just going to, like, be at home, be married, and have a kid, and, like, that's it. So, much love to Cameron and respect.
Love and respect. I bumped into her in New York once in front of my Starbucks, in front of my work, and she was very nice about it. So thank you for that, Cameron.
Is she very tall?
She's very tall. I had to look up at her, and then I wasn't sure at first because it was only a split second, but she was like, oh, I'm so sorry. And then we went about our ways, but she was very tall and very beautiful.
Was this still in the JT era?
Like, no. This was probably in 2016-ish.
Oh, okay. So this is already, like, was she already with Madden at that point?
I think so. I think she had already retired at that point, so probably. But you know what? You're a lovely human being, Cameron Diaz, just from that one very minor interaction.
Look, I love that movie, and I'll watch it to death, but, like, yeah. Come on.
I love
also,
that movie.
There's some, like, if you Google it on the internet, there's a ton of continuity issues about where exactly her house is and
we
how
don't
Kate
watch movies like that for continuity
and
things.
How Kate Winslet gets to her house and, like, based on the angle of the free, like, where she's driving on the PCH and shit like that. Just, you know, I'm just saying.
We watch those movies for warm and fuzzies, not for continuity issues, not because we want our brains to work very hard. We want to turn off our brains and watch something warm and fuzzy.
It's fine. It's not like I have a lot of problems with it, but there are problems. Let's just be real. Look, Mr. Napkinhead, great scene. I have no, like, the
such
two
a great
little girls,
such
adorable.
Such a great scene.
Many, many things I love about this movie. Just hear me out. There's just, you know, little things here and there that I don't have off the top of my head. When it comes to Christmas time, we'll do an episode. I don't know how we're going to fit it into the scheme of this, but we will.
They're probably going to announce a sequel soon or something.
I will say that in this movie, much like in Normal People, there's a lot of falling in love over, like, text messages and emails.
Way to circle
or
it
letters.
You're so professional.
I'm just saying.
This is different, though. I feel like this is like Normal People meets The Fault in Our Stars, kind of. It meets in the middle, right?
How is it like Fault in Our Stars?
Well, like, because they in The Fault in Our Stars, they have, like, those texts, those, like, really twee text screens or whatever. And they have text screens on this, too. But in Normal People, they don't have that at all. And so I feel like this one's very much, like, in the middle of the two things. Like, I actually feel like this did give me Normal People vibes in that, like, all three of their self-actualizations are very, like, subtle and done slowly and, like, and it's just very sweetly done. And I feel like that's the same for Normal People. So I definitely get the comparison.
Except that there's lots of sex in that one.
Yeah.
And this could not be more chaste.
It's very chaste.
I also just like the fake applications, like, pay me on Hushmo or, like, find me on Ghost Messenger.
Oh, yeah. Wait, is Ghost Messenger supposed to be Facebook Messenger? And why is Facebook Messenger more secure than a text message? I don't get it.
I feel like Ghost Messenger is supposed to be WhatsApp.
Oh, is WhatsApp more secure?
Which is also owned by Facebook. Yeah, because I think it can, like, disappear and stuff. I don't know. We need to get, like, a child TikTok expert or something. Like, we need to get, like, my niece or somebody who's, like, under the age of, like, 15 to explain this to us.
Great.
If you haven't watched the half of it and you're at home,
watch
stay
it.
Home.
Mm-hmm.
Watch the half of it. And if you're Stephanie Kim, stay at home and watch Birds of Prey. And I will watch Ghostbusters and we will
reconvene.
No longer have to be ashamed of that.
Yeah. Reconvene next time. All right.
We'll reconvene next time. Thanks for joining us. We hope you enjoyed this episode. Add us on the interwebs. And thanks so much for listening.
Thank you. If you made it this far, we're very impressed.
God bless.
Bye. Thank you.